I think she has a tremendous sense of injustice, and she recognizes that she has the platform and the voice to try to correct that injustice. And that really drives her. I think her political influence has really not been served well. People are unaware of her political involvement in the 1920s and the 1930s until her death.
She may have been the first Indigenous American to speak in her own voice instead of white Americans speaking for her, the first to use essays and oral tradition stories and official reports and even operas to talk about the realities of Native American life and demand change. And in the process, she pushed against the supposedly immovable force of the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the national government, earning enemies and punishment along the way. While many may know of the American Indian movement in the 1960s and 70s, which occupied government buildings, Wounded Knee, and Alcatraz, lesser known is the creative work and life of the indigenous woman in the early 1900s who paved the way. How did writing empower a community? How did truth-telling defy the powers that be and embolden generations to come? And what can we learn from Zitkala Shah about how to make art as resistance today and tomorrow? From Rebel Yell Creative, this is The Art of Resistance, a podcast about channeling our rage and fear into creation and using writing, music, and all kinds of art to resist the status quo. I'm your host and producer, Amy Lee Lillard, and I'm an author, podcaster, and queer autistic woman who's been obsessing over artists who resisted since I was a kid. And today, I'm looking to make all the weird art and help others do the same. This song comes from the Densmore Recordings, a collection of live music by Sioux tribal members in the early 1900s. She was born as Gertrude on the Yankton Dakota Sioux Reservation in South Dakota in 1876. In essays that she wrote later, she described a quiet yet vibrant childhood, surrounded by her mother, aunts, and her people. But at the same time, she felt her mother's deep sadness. Reaches for the Wind was of the first Native American generation forced to adapt to reservation life. She would talk to her daughter of the past, the before. They were happy, she said, but the paleface stole their lands and drove them here. When Gertrude was 8 years old, missionaries arrived in the reservation. They talked to the children, spinning tales of riding on an iron horse to a land full of apples. They asked the kids to join them. She was thrilled by the stories and begged her mother to let her go. Immediately, she realized her mistake. Gertrude rode the train to Wabash, Indiana, to the Quaker-run boarding school. There, her long hair, tied to her home, to her culture, was quickly chopped off. The school was cold and hard, and the nights were filled with crying. She found the apple orchard, but the apples were dying off. The Wabash School was just one of a system of schools designed to forcibly assimilate Indigenous people. And by assimilate, the federal government meant erase. The schools outlawed the children's tribal languages. They banned cultural practices and religious traditions. The kids were beaten and punished when they broke these rules.
Kill the Indian, but save the man. That was that concept that was there. They'll beat it out of us. They'll do anything to get it out of us, even change our appearance, cut our hair, put different clothes on us. All of those things are very traumatic.
That was Virgil Taken Alive, board member, Standing Rock Elders Preservation Council, in a 2022 interview.
And where I came from, the Catholic Church was so powerful that you were going straight to hell if they caught you doing something, you know, out of the ordinary. Even talking and speaking Lakota, that they really watched that close.
That was Terry Yellowfat, board member, Standing Rock Elders Preservation Council. The schools acted as part of the broader Bureau of Indian Affairs philosophy and methods. Starting in 1883, the Indian Offenses Act outlawed traditional Native practices and religious observances, like the Sioux Sun Dance. A few years into school, Gertrude returned to her mother on the reservation. But like immigrant kids or minority kids in majority culture, she found she'd been irrevocably changed. She didn't fit like she used to. There was a wedge between her and her mother and the broader community. She'd been devastated at school and homesick, but now that she was home, she was devastated again. In later essays and stories, she wrote, "My mother had never gone inside of a schoolhouse, and so she was not capable of comforting her daughter who could read and write. Even nature seemed to have no place for me. I was neither a wee girl nor a tall one, neither a wild Indian nor a tame one." So she went back to school. She graduated and went to college and studied violin and eventually became a teacher at another boarding school. "Often I wept in secret," she wrote, "wishing I had gone west to be nourished by my mother's love instead of remaining among a cold race whose hearts were frozen hard by prejudice." In 1900, the school sent her back to her reservation to recruit more students. She was shocked at what she found. The family home was falling apart. The people on the res lived in deep poverty, and worst of all, white settlers were stealing and occupying their land. She went back to school with critical eyes and saw again the torment she experienced as a child. She saw how the school deeply restricted what the kids learned. She saw how they were set up to live small. And she started to write. Under her new name of Zitkala Shah, which meant Red Bird in Sioux, she wrote personal essays describing her idyllic childhood and then her traumatic schooling. She talked about the deep pain she felt and the inherent cruelty of schools stealing children and erasing their culture. The essays appeared in Atlantic Magazine and Harper's in early 1900, and as a result, she was fired from the school. She went back to the reservation and worked as a clerk for the tribal offices. She also collected oral stories told in Sioux from elders down the line. The stories became a book, Old Indian Legends, the first to translate the stories and preserve them for future generations. She also wrote an article in The Atlantic called Why I Am a Pagan. I feel in keen sympathy with my fellow creatures, for I seem to see clearly again that all are akin. The racial lines which once were bitterly real now serve nothing more than marking out a living mosaic of human beings. A Christian pugilist commented upon a recent article of mine, grossly perverting the spirit of my pen. Still, I would not forget that the pale-faced missionary and the hoodooed aborigine are both God's creatures, though small indeed their own conceptions of infinite love. A wee child toddling in a wonder world, I prefer to their dogma my excursions into the natural gardens, where the voice of the Great Spirit is heard in the twittering of birds, the rippling of mighty waters, and the sweet breathing of flowers. During this time, she married, and together, she and her husband moved to the Ute Reservation in Utah to work for the reservation there. In 1910, she met a white professor at BYU who was interested in the tribal practice of the sun dance. It was a sacred Sioux ritual that had been banned by the government, just like so many rituals and religious practices across tribes. Together, she and the professor created the Sun Dance Opera, a unique piece of art bridging two cultures. P. Jane Heffen, the editor of a 2001 book that brought together the Sun Dance Opera and additional writings from Zitkalasha, spoke about this in the Unsung History podcast.
So they talked about different topics for the opera, and they decided to use the Sun Dance as a framework for an opera. So it's structurally, it's really fascinating. And in the original productions, which were done in Utah in 1912 to 1914, they would perform on stage, but they would have members of the Ute tribe. The Utes would perform some of their traditional dances. It fits pretty consistently with stage performances, traveling performances that would happen in the early 1910s and so forth.
This is the opening song of the Sun Dance from the Densmore recordings. In 1921, Zitkalasha brought together many of her essays, along with additional stories, into another book, American Indian Stories. Later, she also published a report entitled Oklahoma's Poor Rich Indians. In it, she wrote about Native tribes being exploited and defrauded by outsiders to get at their oil-rich lands, stories later told in Killers of the Flower Moon and the subsequent movie. The article was instrumental in getting the government to investigate. While Zitkalasha and her husband lived in Utah, they saw the deeply racist treatment of the federal officials against the Uinta and Uri peoples. Witnessing this and remembering her own experiences in Sioux land, she joined the Society of American Indians. This was a group founded by and run by Native peoples. They wanted to end the corrupt and violent reservation system, keeping them poor and cut off from culture. But even more than that, they wanted to enfranchise Native peoples, giving them citizenship and the right to vote, because they didn't have it. Zitkalasha edited the American Indian magazine from the Society, and she used her voice and her writing to spread the word about this mission. In many instances, her writing previewed what would later be known as the Red Power Movement in the 1970s. She talked about abolishing the Bureau of Indian Affairs, allowing all Native cultural practices, retaining or even reclaiming land, and even the idea that Indigenous culture was morally superior to white culture. Thank you. By the end of World War I, the citizenship and voting issue was even more urgent. 25% of the adult male Native population had served in the war. That was compared to 15% of all other American males. She said, if the Indian is good enough to fight for America, he is good enough to be considered American, with all the rights and privileges associated. At the same time, Zitkala Shah was working deep in the women's suffrage movement. She helped the efforts that led to the 19th Amendment in 1920, and then she traveled around the U.S. calling on white women to use their newly won suffrage rights to help enfranchise Native peoples. And in 1924, in part due to her advocacy, Congress passed the Indian Citizenship Act that endowed full citizenship rights to all Native-born people in the country. However, this didn't guarantee the vote. States retained the authority to decide who could or could not vote, and some states began to adopt strategies similar to Jim Crow laws in the South. So Zitkala Shah and her husband founded the National Council of American Indians in 1926. And this organization went even further than the previous one, working explicitly for universal suffrage. And for the rest of her life, she served as president, fundraiser, and speaker for that group. From everything mentioned about Zitkala Shah so far, you'd think she was a slam dunk of an indigenous pioneer and hero. But in many ways, her legacy has been controversial. After getting married and having a child, Zitkala Shah did an about-face. After writing about proudly being a pagan and declaring the Christian-led schools violent and wrong, she became Catholic. This, combined with the fact that she worked for the Quaker schools for a time, led some activists and indigenous folks to look at Zitkala Shah with suspicion. Also, she became fixated on the use of peyote in indigenous populations. The drug was often used in religious ceremonies, and she watched it grow among the Ute. She claimed that peyote was a deadly danger and not truly aligned with their culture, but spread by outside influence. And to spread the word about her anti-peyote message, she allied with some of the biggest enemies of Native peoples, including the leadership of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Finally, when Zitkala Shah created the Sundance Opera, it was problematic from the start. She was Dakota, which did not use the Sundance as much as the Lakota. But Zitkala Shah also had the bad fortune to partner with a grifter. When she worked with the white BYU professor to make the Sun Opera in 1913, they adapted the ritual to appeal to white audiences. And then, in 1938, the professor cut out Zitkala Shah, creating new productions without crediting her work and stripping out much of the realism in favor of Wild West-type tropes. Because of all these things, many activists and indigenous people over the years after Zitkala Shah said she was controversial, said she wasn't worth looking to as a role model or hero. P. Jane Heffin said,
"A lot of critics and a lot of scholars say, well, she did this for this reason, and I even read work who people who thought she was bipolar and, you know, different, projecting their own imagery on her own actions.
But the truth is much more complicated. Zitkala Shah was writing and speaking in a time where she had to walk a tightrope. The image of Native Americans was so terrible in mainstream society that she had to balance writing the truth with not alienating her audience. She had to play the game of respectability politics that so many groups have to play, even now. She had to navigate a government that was brutal and mercenary. And during World War I and after, she had to work around stringent censorship laws. In terms of converting to Catholicism, that was at a time when the Catholic Church frequently partnered with Native American support organizations. When Zikalashah came out against peyote, it was at a time when women's suffrage movements were often deeply tied to anti-alcohol and drug movements. And let's face it, everyone has bad luck sometimes when it comes to picking creative collaborators. When it comes down to it, Zikalashah was a complicated person, just like everyone. She was built from an erased and manufactured culture, torn apart in many ways. She tried to work within systems just as often as she tried to tear them down. She exemplified the paradoxes that a colonized population face. And she gave a platform to indigenous voices at a time when the only voices were white ones, spreading the lies about degenerate and childlike native peoples that needed a firm white hand.
American Indian Stories, which contains her boarding school narratives. And if she were to ever only be known for this, it would be an amazing achievement, because she was one of the first Native authors to write without an amanuensis, without somebody translating for her or heavily editing what she wrote.
What can we learn from Zikalashah? What can we do as creative people in this fucked up world? Because we are all creative, we can all find ways to resist. Today, Zikalashah is increasingly recognized as a huge pioneer in indigenous rights and representation. And the key tenets of much of her writing and activist work appeared in similar forms in the 20-Point Indian Manifesto and other demands from the Red Power organizations in the 1970s. Her story is one of finding her voice and then giving voice to others like her. And that story isn't pure, by some accounts, but whose is? Sticking rigidly to one viewpoint and never changing is not a badge of honor in real life. That's one thing I think we can take from Zikalashah's story. We are people who live and change and evolve. And not only that, women face unique pressures on our public viewpoints, as do individuals who are Black, Indigenous, and people of color. Despite all that, Zikalashah did the work. She wrote the things. She told her stories and those of her family and culture. She pushed as hard as she could against the status quo and created art to change it. So here's what we do from here. We tell our stories in our voice. We embrace our cultures and create work to honor them. We create revolutionary art to reach the people who need to see it and hear it. And we don't think of this as short term. Even if we get a new administration down the road, even if we miraculously come out of this terrifying, tyrannical moment, there's so much to fight against and for. This is a long-term commitment to making art for a better world. The Art of Resistance is a podcast for the artists, the lovers of art, and people who want to resist but don't know how. These stories are designed to help us find inspiration from the past and empower us all to find some hope for today and tomorrow. I'm Amy Lee Lillard, and I wrote, narrated, and produced this show. And there's so much more to this story. At artofresistance.space, You'll find sources, images, and videos for this episode and all the others. Here's an easy way to learn more about Art as Resistance. Sign up for the free newsletter at artofresistance.space and get stories and tips every week. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.